Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to documentary filmmaker Joseph Dorman, whose latest movie is Sholem Aleichem, Laughing in the Darkness. Stick around. As the good book says, if you spit in the air, it lands in your face. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Stop by and check it out. There are more than 900 archived celebrity and pop culture interviews for your listening pleasure. The show is brought to you today by Audible. Audible is offering Mr. Media listeners a free audiobook download and a 14-day trial offer to give you a chance to check out their very cool service. I love listening to books on tape. If you've never tried it before, actors or sometimes the authors themselves read to you. It's great for the commute, the beach, or even unwinding before bed. You can choose a free audiobook from Audible's enormous library of titles, including two by Sholem Aleichem, including Tevye the Milkman and The Story of Tevye the Dairyman. Here's an excerpt.
A man slaves, works himself to the bone, is ready to lie down and die. It shouldn't happen to the worst enemy of the Jews. Suddenly, don't ask me how or why, it rains gold on him from all sides. In a word, Revach ve'atzolo yamod la'yehudim, just like it says in the Bible. That's too long a verse to translate, but the general gist of it is that as long as a Jew lives and breathes in this world and hasn't more...
You could also download The Profiler, written by famed criminal profiler Pat Brown and yours truly, which Pat will read to you personally. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/radio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/radio for your free audiobook. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of 16-year-old boys in heavy fake beards, all speaking in high school Yiddish accents, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I owe my first kiss to Sholem Aleichem, and my second, too. The first was Loy Neville. The second, not long after, was Diane Dunn. Now, both occurred backstage during dress rehearsals for the North Brunswick Township High School production of Fiddler on the Roof. Surely you've heard of it. Seth Kaufman, then 15, played Tevye, a revelatory performance that no one who saw it ever forgot. And Phyllis Lyons played one of Tevye's daughters, and maybe you've seen her since then in The Bridges of Madison County, or more recently in episodes of House or Rizzoli and Isles. And parenthetically, she also married actor Adam Arkin. But I digress. I didn't know Loy or Diane before that. I was in eighth grade, they were ninth. But I was never the same after that. These two pretty girls talked to me, they laughed at my jokes, and their friendship gave me a self-confidence I never knew before. We never dated, but I walked one or the other of them home pretty much every day after that. And it's all because I worked on the backstage crew of a high school production of Fiddler on the Roof. So for that reason alone, I feel an honest debt to the storytelling talents of legendary Jewish writer Sholem Aleichem. That's the main reason I'm pleased to help spread the word of a new documentary film, Sholem Aleichem, Laughing in the Darkness, by writer, director, and producer Joseph Dorman. The movie, which will be shown at the Toronto, San Francisco, and Jerusalem Jewish Film Festivals this summer, is narrated by actor Alan Rosenberg and features the voices of Peter Rieger and Rachel Dratch, among others. Well, as King David said, I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. So Joseph Dorman, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you for having me. I'd also like to say, just real quickly, Bob, that we are also opening theatrically in New York on July 8th.
Oh.
And then we'll be going into theaters across the country soon after that. So hopefully it'll be coming to an art theater near you.
Excellent. And you've got a website people can come and probably check for that information?
Absolutely. They can go. But probably the best thing to do is go to the website for the movie, which is www.sholemaleichemthemovie.com. And there are many spellings of Sholem Aleichem, so it's S-H-O-L-E-M. A-L-E-I-C-H-E-M, and that will have a list of screenings. You can also connect to the official Facebook page, which will also have news of other events, etc. So that's the best way to keep track of what's happening with the film.
Yeah, I have to admit, I hadn't actually considered the spelling of Sholem Aleichem since I was a teenager, so I had to keep going back and checking, did I get it right?
Well, it is one of the frustrating things because it's transliteration, there are a number of spellings. Uh-huh. So I stuck with one, and there it is.
Got it. Yeah, and then plus when you actually say it, you have to remember to get a little bit of phlegm there at the end on the last syllable. So
that's right.
Could you tell the people who did or did not know how to say it properly because they either did or did not get the phlegm?
You can definitely often tell the difference between a Jewish and non-Jewish pronunciation of Shalom Aleichem. Yeah. The interesting thing, and something that I didn't know, and a common mistake that's made, which, as I say, I made as well until I was corrected, is that because Shalom Aleichem is a pen name and means several things, basically peace be upon you, but also became a common greeting, hello and goodbye as well. But because that was the pen name of a man named Sholem Rabinowitz, you can't ever refer to Mr. Aleichem or Aleichem. It's always got to be Sholem Aleichem. And someone pointed out it's as if you were talking about Howdy Doody and said Mr. Doody. So that's the one thing I learned, even though I come from the tribe.
You know, I think just getting you to say Mr. Doody was just worth the whole price of the admission here today.
I'm glad.
So, tell me something about you first. First of all, I'm asking this for a reason, but how old are you, Joe?
I'm 53.
All right. And I'm guessing Jewish?
I'm Jewish,
okay.
Yeah.
And do you remember the first time that you saw a production or had any involvement, per se, in Fiddler on the Roof?
You know, I can't pinpoint it as exactly as you can. I was never in a production of film of okay. Fiddler on the Roof. I must have seen it when I was a kid. I have a memory of seeing the movie, going to see the movie. Actually, you know, it's funny. You're the first person who's asked me that.
Oh.
And I all of a sudden flashed on a memory of I'm from Detroit originally, of being outside the movie theater waiting to be picked up as a kid after having seen Fiddler on the Roof.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's one of those things that for so many people, it's sort of part of the air you breathe. You don't even... It's like the Bible at this point. It's there. It was always there. You can't imagine a time it wasn't there.
Right, right. And what year did the movie come out?
I think the movie, it was 73.
Okay.
Or 71. I always forget this. But I think actually it was 71 because the Broadway musical was 64.
Hmm. It was, and that explains it. I wasn't sure of the timing of the film, but I knew it was a very formative time for me. I'm just a couple years younger than you, and that was, you know, that's that point where you're, you know, everything that you encounter hits you, and I remember the film, and then suddenly we're doing the play, and you know, I still have contact with a number of the people who were involved with that, and that was, well, as I said in the introduction, I didn't mean to hijack your introduction, by the way, so much as just to, you know, explain why this is such a touchstone. When did you get connected to the idea of doing a documentary?
It was about a little over a decade ago, actually, and I was looking around for another project, and a friend of mine, who's actually a professor of Yiddish, a man named Jeffrey Chandler, had initially suggested the idea of making a film about Shlomo Aleichem's immigration to America, because he was, unlike so many in the Jewish community, a failed immigrant to America.
Mm.
And it was a very interesting story. Jeff had actually curated an exhibition about it. And I, you know, as I really knew very little about Shlomo Aleichem, except that he was the man behind Fiddler on the Roof. And I didn't have a particularly strong reaction to it. I thought, let me see. What I did know of Shlomo Aleichem actually probably made me more skeptical than anything else. And then, of course, the project grew. The more I learned about him, the more I read his stories, the more I realized I had stumbled onto a genius and not some folksy humorist, the person I had thought him to be, and that not only was he a great writer, but his work conjured an entire world that was enormously formative for who I was, and yet it was a world I knew very, very little about. So that was a very, very powerful experience for me.
I was very surprised. I knew nothing about him as well. I think I had just kind of assumed that he was he came and went around the turn of the century, the 19th into the 20th century, and was very surprised that, you know, he actually was involved. I mean, I wouldn't have ever guessed that he had been to New York even, which is why you called him a failed immigrant, I think, because
right.
he came and he put, you tell the story in the film that he had two shows on Broadway simultaneously and they both miserably failed.
That's right. Actually, not on Broadway, the Yiddish Theater.
Yiddish Theater, I'm sorry.
But the Yiddish Theater at that point, Broadway in some ways, metaphorically, is not at all wrong, because at that point in New York, the Yiddish Theater was an enormously vibrant, energetic scene with many theaters, extremely popular entertainment. So yeah, I mean, he had thought he was at that point, by the time he came here, the greatest Jewish writer alive, the most popular Jewish writer alive, certainly, and expected to make a great, great splash in America, and then fell into the faction-ridden waters of American Jewish culture. And we can talk about that more if you want.
Yeah, I actually know a little bit about the Jewish, the Yiddish theater from that time. I did a biography of an old comic book artist named Will Eisner, and his dad was a scene painter in the old Yiddish theaters. And I know in the book we talk about a couple of the Yiddish actors who later became very well known with Americanized names, and Paul Muni, yeah, was one of the guys.
Wiesenfall or Wiesenfield or something, yeah, that's right.
I was going to reach for the book, and then you named it, so you saved me.
I actually did a review of a book on the Yiddish theater a few years ago, and it really is remarkable. I mean, that what you're talking about, the influence, even though the Yiddish theater is long gone, with one very notable exception, at least in New York, of the Volksbühne, National Yiddish Theater, which has been in constant operation for, I think, a century now. But obviously the Yiddish theater scene as we know it, it has long gone. But its tentacles, its roots, its branches into American culture are deep and wide. I mean, this review I almost wanted, or my title for it wasn't picked up by the editor, was Marlon Brando's Yiddish Accents. Because Marlon Brando's teacher, the woman he revered, Stella Adler, was the daughter of the great actor of the Yiddish theater, Jacob Adler. So it's a really interesting story, only partially known.
Is Shaul Halachim one of the most quintessential of these Jewish authors because of his stories, the universality of them, or something else?
What's interesting about Shlomo Aleichem, or maybe I should say this is not interesting at all, because it defines a great writer, was that he was at one and the same time the quintessentially Jewish author and capturing some aspect of Jewishness in a way that I think no one else has captured in quite the same way. There was a poll among writers and academics of the great Jewish book, and it was Tevye the Dairyman, the Tevye the Dairyman stories. But at the same time that he was the quintessential Jewish author, because he was a great author, he's also a quintessentially universal author.
Mm-hmm.
And so he combines both of those things in the same way you could say of a Tolstoy or Melville or whoever you would want to describe as someone who's both a great national author and yet someone who's part of world literature.
Are his stories taught in high school or college English the way some other people of his era who were not Yiddish or Jewish authors?
My gut, I don't know for sure, but my gut feeling is no. I mean, so far as I know, I think the only curriculum he would be taught in would be if you were in a college, maybe a college course on Jewish literature or on Yiddish literature. There was a Yiddish school system for a while, but interestingly, or not, Yiddish literature has been marginalized, and it's been marginalized not only by non-Jews but by Jews as well. It's something that has not crossed over, and the only way it really did cross over for all intents and purposes was through something like Fiddler on the Roof. But whereas a Kafka or a Saul Bellow in America, Kafka obviously in Europe and Czechoslovakia, et cetera, whereas they're both world off, you know, on the world scene and part of their national literatures, Yiddish literature really was seen, I think, because it was a literature of a people at the time who were poor and essentially disenfranchised, it didn't have the reputation ultimately. And one of the things, and I'm only a small part of this because there are many other people who have been doing this for years, but one of the things I would like the film to do is not only bring more people to Sholem Aleichem, but to many of his fellow Yiddish authors who are great authors in their own right.
Hmm. Well, let's take a quick break. This is Bob Adelman, and you're listening to and hopefully watching the Mr. Media interview with documentary filmmaker Joseph Dorman, whose new film is Sholem Aleichem, Laughing in the Darkness. And we'll be right back.
You work too hard, you ate too much, the cheesecake made you greedy. Let your aching head and stomach hear this message from Old Speedy. Alka-Seltzer, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Ah, those speedy Alka-Seltzer bubbles burst into action to relieve your upset stomach and aching head fast. If only as directed. Oh, what a relief it is. What a relief.
This is Question. You know me as the amazing Question. Whenever I'm in Vegas, I enjoy picking up girls with Mr. Media.
This is Bob Adelman, and you're listening to and hopefully watching the Mr. Media interview with documentary filmmaker Joseph Dorman, whose new movie is Sholem Aleichem, Laughing in the Darkness. You know, one of the things I've been thinking about, you're doing a film, it's mostly in black and white with the, you know, more recent cutaways to experts. But how much of a visual legacy do we have of Sholem Aleichem? You made this documentary, there's little bits of photos, there's a little bit of film, I think, but how much was actually available to you of the man himself?
Yeah. Actually, there's no film. There is one audio recording of his voice, or what was, you know, on one of the earliest forms of records, probably a cylinder of some sort, which is the only known, I know, extant recording of his voice. There are a fairly substantial, for someone who lived from 1859 to 1916, I was happy to see a fairly substantial number of photos, and I kept finding them there along the way. I mean, there's a Beit Sholem Aleichem, a Sholem Aleichem museum in Israel, which houses his works and a number of photos, but there are also a fairly large family, and each of the family members has certain photos, one in particular actually in Florida, a grandson. So there was that kind of record. In terms of the world he lived in, of course, film has something like 300 archival photos and some footage as well. And that was all taken, for the most part, the earliest photo in the film, I think, was taken around 1914, part of an expedition by the great ethnographer Shinansky. But there were also photos by some wonderful photographers in the 20s and 30s, and they were photographing the shtetl at that point essentially as it had existed for centuries. They were photographing the people who were wearing the same outfits that they might have been wearing 100 years ago in buildings that had been in existence for quite a period of time. So it was taking a snapshot in 1920 of a period that was in some ways frozen in time. So that was what allowed me to be able to document a world that really at that point in the late 19th and early 20th century was all but unphotographed and undocumented.
Well, that's what I wondered. It would think it would be kind of difficult to go into something like this knowing that you don't have any audio or film of your subject. You don't necessarily really know how he sounds, even.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess you work around that.
You work around that. And I think that it was good. The fact that there were photos of him was important. I was quite nervous about recreating the shtetl in that world of 19th century Jewry. You know, I tend to choose counterintuitive subjects for my films. I mean, a lot of my films are really, in many ways, based around talk. Mm-hmm. I feel that, you know, film is really, I mean, it's obviously preeminently a visual medium, but it's a medium in which people also get to talk, and I'm not frightened to put someone up there talking on the screen if I think they're a passionate, interesting speaker. And I made a film a number of years ago about four writers, intellectuals, a group called the New York Intellectuals. And when I was working on that, people kept thinking and saying aloud to me, including the people I was doing the film on, that it was going to be boring. Who wants to see a film about, you know, people who are writers? But I think in the end, hopefully it wasn't, that it seemed to get good reviews. And I think people respond to thoughtful, smart people. And in this case, I mean, I don't want to turn people off because it is an incredibly visual film. I mean, these photographs are remarkable, remarkable photographs of the world, very poignant. And so, as I say, it was a little counterintuitive, maybe a bit of dumb luck, and, you know, the decision to just plunge ahead.
You know, speaking of the visuals, I obviously got permission to use some footage from Fiddler on the Roof, the film, and I wondered, I'm figuring that could have gone one of two ways, that either the studio looked at it and say, hey, this is going to be a great way for us to continue to keep this film in front of new generations, so we should cooperate with this guy, or they looked at it and said, you know, let's get as much of a licensing fee as we can, because who knows when this movie will ever make another penny. Which was it?
Well, it would have been the latter. But I use these clips actually fair use.
Ah.
So it would have been quite a steep fee because the people are not charitable in that sense. But I made sure I worked with a lawyer to make sure that everything was used properly according to fair use laws, which was important and critical. I have good friends who are fighters for more copyright freedom because it can put a stranglehold, particularly on documentary filmmakers. It can cost exorbitant amounts of money if you were to have to actually license the footage.
So you're probably timing segments right down to the second.
You have to be very, very careful. You can't use too much.
We go through that on here now. Now that we do the video so much, we're very careful about what we use.
Yeah.
And what we don't use. And then we're talking about photos and then sources. You have interviews with Yiddish experts and I guess people who
his
are
his granddaughter.
I'm sorry.
His granddaughter, his 100-year-old granddaughter.
That woman was 100 years old.
She is today. She was only 92, I think, when I interviewed her, but she's 100 years old today.
There's some good genes in that family. She does not look that old.
No, she's amazing.
Yeah. And now, did you have
Belle
to...
Kaufman.
I'm sorry?
Belle Kaufman is her name. She's an author in her own right. She wrote Up the Down Staircase many years ago.
Oh, wow. Did you have to twist her arm at all to do this, or was she pretty eager to participate?
She is probably the number one ambassador for her grandfather, and has been for years and years and years. She has spoken, I think, anywhere and everywhere about him, and she's a marvelous storyteller. She's the last person alive who actually knew him. She was 5 years old when he died. There's a great picture of her as a young child with sitting on his lap. But she's a remarkable woman and has wonderful family stories about him.
Hmm. Is there a lot that had to be cut for length in the film that we might see in a DVD?
There was plenty that was cut as always with these films, and I'm not sure I haven't gotten to that point yet, but hopefully I'll be able to put some of it on the DVD. Yeah, it's a very rich subject. He was a very rich, you know, rich. He had a rich life and an interesting life.
It's too bad you're in such a hurry because the stories I could tell you, bushels and baskets of stories, whole crates full of stories. But if you can spare a moment, I'll tell you one story, a true story.
The reading of a story of Shalom Aleichem on Friday night became a Jewish family ritual.
Shalom Aleichem is trying to paint a portrait of a society at the same time as that society is dissolving.
His genius was he saw where Jews were going, but he also knew where they came from.
Jews have undergone a tremendous transformation, and Sholem Aleichem, more than any writer, has captured its challenges. He's captured its humor.
As the saying goes, if you have money, you're not only clever, but handsome too and can sing like a nightingale.
Sholem Aleichem never uses humor to escape from what's terrible. He uses humor to enable you to understand that there is a perspective from which the most terrible thing is funny too.
He wrote in his autobiography, to make people laugh was almost a sickness for me.
May the worms eat you, a toothache make you
in
yell.
Short, I'm now in real estate.
My real estate comes.
I pronounce you a certified lunatic.
I'm so happy I could.
We're off to America.
Sholem Aleichem began to write a series of essays about Tavia the milkman and his seven daughters.
When you have daughters, they say, forget them, Gelechter. You forget to laugh because daughters is a serious business.
Huddle, my second daughter, pretty as a picture. And if looks aren't bad enough, she has the brains to go with it.
Fiddler was created from the perspective of the promised land and how good it is to reconnect with tradition.
Shmuel was exploring one question, how to be Jews in a modern world.
He gave us the literature which could bridge a gap when we're shifting not from one generation to the next. This is going from one epoch to the next.
There's no question that he becomes a true culture hero.
He's the ultimate modern, or to put it more accurately, he's the precursor for us.
Charlie was his name, we hear.
He had an engine and he sure had fun. He used good and plenty candy to make his train run.
Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Charlie says, really rings the bell. Charlie says, love my good and plenty. Don't know any other candy that I love so well.
Hi, this is Raquel Welch. Yes, that Raquel. And I'd rather stick needles in my ears than listen to one more minute of Mr. Media Radio. Ugh.
Joe, we were talking about Sholem Aleichem's granddaughter. What did she tell you that you didn't already know or that surprised you?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if it was a particular thing, but she was able to paint a portrait of him in a very intimate way that only a family member can. And she talks about things like his vanity, the fact that here was this guy, and he was a very generous man and a very humane guy, but how he would pluck the gray hairs out of his beard. He was a bit of a dandy. She talked about his gambling on the stock market. And she talked about little family pranks. This actually didn't make it into the film, but I think it's actually on YouTube. But he would do funny things like when there was a party, people were at a party and they'd taken off their shoes. He would go outside and mix up people's shoes. And he was a little prankster. So it's that wonderful look at a great man, the interesting, intimate side of a great man.
I thought I remember when she talked about plucking the gray hairs from his beard and that always bothered him. And the stuff that you have in there about him playing the stock market, that's just, I mean, part of me, I was very surprised by it, but part of me also, having known a lot of old Yiddish men over the years, did not surprise me.
Yeah. Well, you know, he was an interesting character. He was a terrible, terrible businessman. Mm. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact, I mean, what's interesting in part about Sholem Aleichem is he comes from a generation, he's very different from the men and women he was actually documenting in his stories or writing about in his stories. He was an assimilated Russian Jew in the same way that we're assimilated American Jews. And he lived in a large city, Kiev, for much of his life. And he had the luck of inheriting this money from his father-in-law, who's a wealthy man. And the idea of being able to play the stock exchange, of being able to all of a sudden have this money and perhaps make more money with it, I think was just something that he couldn't pass up. And what's interesting, of course, was that at the same time he was doing this, of course, in the evenings, late into the evenings, he was writing his Yiddish stories. And a lot of the reason he was playing the stock exchange was probably, in fact, not just to support himself, but really to support his Yiddish writing habit. Because he was taking that money and he was creating the first Yiddish literary annual, which was modeled after Russian literary annuals, which was a mark of high literature. So he really was had a goal with that money. It wasn't simply to become even more wealthy himself. It was really to use that for something that he cared about more than anything else in the world, and that was the creation of a real modern Yiddish literature.
Now, in his day, how did most people come to know his stories? It wasn't through books.
It wasn't at all. And in fact, the fact that after he lost his fortune, he was unable to put out this literary annual was in some ways a saving grace for him, even though it destroyed him financially. I mean, he had already been publishing in what was then the Young Yiddish Press, which was growing over time. I mean, there was problems of Russian censorship, so there were only so many papers, et cetera, et cetera. But the way most writers at that point reached their audience, and this was true not just of Yiddish writers, it's how Charles Dickens, other 19th century writers reached their audience. It was through newspapers or magazines. It was weekly, and he came to most readers in the weekly art supplement of the Yiddish paper on Friday nights.
Well, let's change gears a little bit while we still have a few minutes. I want to talk to you a little bit about the making of a documentary, of course, this one in particular. Documentary is not known necessarily as a way, speaking of getting rich, not necessarily known as a way to get rich. And I'm thinking that making one that will be certainly at the beginning, it's primarily shown at Jewish film festivals, kind of narrows the audience a little further. Or maybe I'm mistaken about all this?
I hope you are. There has been, as I mentioned, we're opening it really basically the best art house in New York, Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, and then, as I say, have plans to expand. I think that, and this is no secret to anyone who's been around the last 15 or 20 years, documentaries in many ways have gained a larger and larger theatrical audience. And it's certainly not going to make anyone wealthy. It's not like gambling on the stock exchange, although there's a certain amount of gambling involved on self-distributing this rather than going with a traditional distributor. But I really hope to find a strong theater-going audience. Other films have shown that that's possible in the past. And I think that this audience is probably primarily Jewish, but I'm hoping to reach out beyond the Jewish audience because Fiddler on the Roof is such a universal work of art. And the stories it's based on, the heavy stories it's based on, are equally universal, and I'm hoping lots of people come out to the theater.
I mean, I'm thinking you play this well in New York, in Toronto, Chicago, Los Angeles.
Philadelphia, Boston,
right,
San Francisco.
Miami, but I'm thinking that in Des Moines, it might not
right.
be quite the sensation.
Well, I can't disagree with you there. I don't know what the size of the Jewish community is in Des Moines or the size of the art house audience in general is in Des Moines, although I'm sure Des Moines is there. I have never been to Des Moines, but as a man from Detroit, I would look askance at anyone saying too much about the Midwest. But, yeah, I mean, I think this is what's known as a limited theatrical release.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not going to every multiplex in the country. Very few documentaries do that, probably Roger Michael Moore is one of the few who's able to do that. So yes, you're looking at a limited theatrical audience, but it's a strong. I think the documentary film audience is a faithful audience, and they are looking for something that's interesting. That's and particularly in the summer, people are looking for something other than the typical sort of Hollywood blockbuster.
Can I ask what the budget for this film was?
you can ask, and I can give you an estimate, because over the years I raised money for it, so I don't even have a strict accounting, but it was somewhere around $500,000.
Not cheap, right. Even spread out over the years, it's still money.
Yes, that's right.
Was there material that did not make the final cut that might show up in a DVD release? Because I assume you would do a DVD because, you know, good way to make back some more money.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there'll definitely be a DVD release. And there, you know, I haven't planned that yet. Obviously, it's in the future, but there is a possibility. There's a lot of wonderful material out there, and if I can, I would love to put it on a DVD.
And so, Joe, what's next for you? This is coming out. I'm sure this has got the focus of your attention for the summer and probably early fall. But what are you working on now?
Working on a few projects. I'm working on a project, a very interesting project about a man in Newark, Dr. James Oleski, who was one of the earliest AIDS pediatricians. He was really a pioneer. This is now the 30th anniversary of the AIDS epidemic. And he was a pioneer. He was the first man or among the first people who really discovered that young children could get AIDS through transmission. But Oleski continues to be, he's a remarkable man and continues to be a pioneer. He works in palliative care, pain management, and hospice care for children. That sounds like a dry subject, but it's something that's taboo in this country, and it sounds perhaps like a depressing subject, but he's such a remarkable man that I think I'm convinced that a documentary on him can both shed light on what's going on in the medical profession and also bring to light this sort of remarkable humanitarian. And then I've just received, along with the partner Oren Radovsky, money from National Endowment for the Humanities to do a history of the Zionist idea. Zionism is obviously continually controversial, maybe more controversial now than ever.
Uh-huh.
And what we wanted to do is make a film not just about the current political crisis or the state of Israel, but about what the idea behind Zionism is and its history, its basis in 19th century nationalism, and how it's been shaped and different variants of it over the years, to give people who may not understand it a deeper idea of what it is behind the idea of the state of Israel and the idea of a nation for the Jewish people. So those are two important films for me right now.
It sounds like you will not be bored.
I hope not to be.
Well, folks, you can catch a film festival screening of Shalom Aleichem, Laughing in the Darkness this summer in Toronto, San Francisco, and Jerusalem, and July 8th at the
Lincoln Plaza Cinemas in New York, followed probably in the next two or three weeks by openings in Los Angeles, Boston, San Francisco, Philadelphia, Washington, and then further parts of the country in the months afterward.
Very good. And for the next closest showing to you, I suggest you visit the official site for the documentary. It's shalomaleichemthemovie.com.
That's correct.
I'm not going to spell it. I'm going to assume that anyone watching this far into this interview can figure out how to spell it. And you can also support the film by liking its Facebook fan page. Joseph Dorman, fascinating to talk to you. Really interesting film to watch. And thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Bob.
Our pleasure. And folks, for more original interviews with America's top documentary filmmakers, you can surf over to our main website, MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. If you've enjoyed today's show, you can subscribe for free to Mr. Media via email, RSS, or iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many parts of the neighborhood shtetl. Show your support of Mr. Media by supporting our sponsors, including Audible. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/radio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/radio. for your free audiobook. We're also supported by thepartyauthority.us. Call DJ Ira for all your party entertainment needs nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJs or visit their website, thepartyauthority.us. If you've got an idea for a guest, a comment on today's show, or would like to advertise on Mr. Media, email me directly at bob@mrmedia.com. You can also call our 24-hour listener line at 1-727 498-4711 and leave a message. Some messages may be used in an upcoming show, and unless you live next door to me, there may be toll charges. You can also follow Mr. Media on Facebook, Twitter, or our new YouTube video channel. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate you giving up a little piece of your day and spending it with Mr. Media. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye, everybody.
Hey, did you know that you can listen to the latest Mr. Media on your phone with the Stitcher app? Stitcher is smart radio for your smartphone. Mr. Media is on demand and on the go with Stitcher. Download Stitcher for your phone today. Get the free download at Stitcher.com. That's S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R.com.